Coming up on Tech News Today, the biggest internet attack in history and how cats can defend you on the internet. Also, Flipboard got even prettier. Was that possible? All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, March 27th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Lantronics, maker of the XPrint server. Print from your iPad, iPhone, or any iOS device to virtually any printer. For more information, visit xprintserver.com/twit and enter the code TWIT to receive free shipping on your order. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPad, Samsung Galaxy, and other smartphones are worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Ayaz Akhtar.
And I'm Jason L.
And this is the team that keeps you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world. And we begin each day with alms for the news fuse. Microsoft announced their next developer conference, Build is what they call it, will take place in San Francisco June 26th through June 28th. And at the same time, VP of Corporate Communications Frank Shaw took to the blogs to officially acknowledge Microsoft Blue. That's the internal name for updates to software, most prominently Windows 8. But there's also versions of Blue updates for phones and servers as well. Shaw said the chances of the shipping versions of these updates have almost no chance of being called Blue, then wisely immediately told people not to respond with, "So you're saying there's a chance." I'm not kidding. He wrote that in his blog. thank you, Frank Shaw. Thank you.
A spam fighting group called Spam House and a Dutch web hosting group called Cyberbunker have gotten into a bit of a mudslinging war and has turned into one of the largest computer attacks on the internet after Cyberbunker was accused of sending a bunch of spam. So the dispute started when Spam House added Cyberbunker to its blacklist, which is used by email providers to weed out spam. Cyberbunker fought back, caused widespread congestion, and jammed infrastructure around the internet, around the world. Millions of internet users have experienced delays in services like Netflix or particular websites. A spokesman for Spam House said the attacks began on March 19th, but had not stopped the group from distributing its blacklist. Can't everybody just get along? Jeez.
Flipboard introduced version 2.0 for iOS today. There are some slight design modifications, but the biggest new feature is user-generated magazines. When you're flipping through your feeds, you will now have the option to clip a story and roll it into your own shareable magazine. Right now, Flipboard 2.0 is for iOS only. Android users can subscribe to those new magazines, but they can't make them yet.
Amazon's X-Ray feature is expanding to television shows. X-Ray delivers more information about, say, the book you're reading in Kindle or the movie you're watching from Amazon Instant. And now, while you watch TV shows on your Kindle Fire, the web, or even the Nintendo Wii, you'll be able to learn more about the characters and actors you're watching. No word if this feature will work on Android or iOS, though.
Game developers on Facebook's platform generated $2.8 billion last year, and Facebook executives are gloating. "Anywhere in the games business, we are investing heavily," says Facebook's Sean Ryan at the Game Developers Conference currently going on here in San Francisco. Candy Crush is Facebook's current number one game, but there's some more interesting statistics, like more than 250 million people are playing games on Facebook each month. And as of February, 55% of the top 400 iOS apps are also integrated with Facebook.
There's a new feature coming to Google Chrome, and it's spell check. When you right-click a word, you'll have a new option called Ask Google for Suggestions. From there, Google will check your spelling, grammar, and more. Chrome will even build a custom dictionary that will be available on your different devices when you use Chrome. The new spell check is coming to Windows, Chrome OS, and Linux, with Mac support to come later. If you're worried about Google reading everything you're typing, this feature is optional.
Ooh yeah, the Android-based game console should start shipping soon to its Kickstarter backers, and in anticipation, the company has teamed up with MakerBot. If you can access a 3D printer and you want to customize your Ooya case, you can get a 3D printing development kit optimized for the second-generation MakerBot replicator that lets you create custom designs and patterns. Plans are available on Thingiverse.com.
Research firm eMarketer has revised its 2014 revenue predictions for Twitter into the black. The firm predicts $528 million this year and $950 million in 2014, with a 53% of that money coming from mobile ads. eMarketer had earlier put that 2014 number at about $800 million, so, you know, it's a nice ramp up. The upwards revision at least partly shows that Twitter might be able to solve this whole mobile marketing puzzle.
Making money. Look at that. What happens when you lose a major battle? Well, you regroup. You amass firepower, and that's Samsung's strategy. Samsung may have lost its biggest patent fight with Apple last year, but they won the 2012 patent arms race, receiving the most mobile patents in 2012 and pushing them to the top of the list for the most mobile patents worldwide, nudging out Nokia. Analyst Chetan Sharma's report also found that by the end of this year, mobile patents will account for 25% of all patents granted.
A firmware upgrade to the Boxy TV brings along DLNA support, a modified TV guide, 3D streaming of Vudu titles, and a bunch of bug fixes. This update will be available within the next 3 days. The Boxy TV's big hook was its cloud DVR service, but with the firmware upgrade, it's going to be a lot easier to stream your content around your home network and even stream content from your phone to your TV.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Lantronics. XPrint Server enables wireless printing from your iPad, your iPhone, or your iPod Touch. If you've tried to print from those, you probably know how frustrating it can be. If you have the wrong printer, which most of us do, there's just not an easy way to do it. You may email it to yourself and print it from your desktop. There's all kinds of workarounds for it. Get rid of the need to print through apps or install software. Get a Lantronics XPrint server. It works with USB or network printers you already own. Whether they're wired or wireless, you can print directly from the iOS native menu. You don't have to install anything. You don't have to buy any apps. You don't even have to download anything. It's compatible with more than 4,000 top brand printers, and it's so easy to use. I was amazed. I honestly did not believe them when they told me how easy it was to use, because everybody always talks about how easy their products to use. It's dead simple. You open it up, you plug it in, and you print. Advanced configuration options are available by the web interface, but one XPrint server can support multiple printers and virtually unlimited iOS devices. And the best part is it turns your USB printer into a network printer. Home Edition is $99, supports up to 8 USB and 2 network printers, plenty for most homes. The Office Edition is $199. That gives you 8 USB printers and unlimited network printers and includes a bunch of network admin features you're going to like, things like Active Directory support. So here's what you do. Go to xprintserver.com/twit for more information and to buy. We've got a special offer. Use the code TWIT to receive free shipping on your order. Remember, visit xprintserver.com/twit, and at checkout, enter that code TWIT. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. All right. We were hoping to get Nicole Perlroth from New York Times on the show today, but because of our first discussion story, which she's covering for the New York Times, she wasn't able to join us, so we'll try to get her back. But very interesting story out there about the fight between Spam House and Cyberbunker that Sarah was mentioning in the news feed. Spam House creates block lists of spammers. They've been doing this since, I think, 1998 or so. Basically, these are lists that allow ISPs to say, we don't have to worry about fighting spam as much. If we put this block list in, we're going to get rid of a whole bunch at virtually no cost. Cyberbunker, which actually exists in a former NATO bunker, it's a five-story bunker that goes like down into the ground, says they will host any website except child porn and anything related to terrorism. So they're a safe harbor. They're like, we're one of these no questions asked. We're going to protect your privacy, allow you to do anything that you need to do on the web. And here's where the problem happened. Spam House added Cyberbunker to a block list. Now, they had had a previous Spam House that had previously done a run in with one of Cyberbunker's ISPs back in the fall. And now they've added Cyberbunker directly to a block list. Everyone assumes Cyberbunker's behind it, but a DDoS attack, a denial of service attack, has been taking place against Spam House since March 19th, and it has grown to the largest ever, 300 megabits per second, targeting Spam House's domain name system servers. It's also targeted Cloudflare. Cloudflare is a company that tries to help you survive if you get too much traffic or you get DDoSed, and now Cloudflare itself has come under attack. Sven Olaf Kampus, he's an activist and a sort of a spokesman for the attacks, accused Spamhaus of abusing their influence and saying they should not be allowed to decide what goes and does not go on the internet. Spamhaus, on the other hand, has alleged that Cyberbunker is in cooperation with criminals from Eastern Europe and Russia. And Steve Linford, who's the chief executive of the Spamhaus project, told BBC that Google's actually coming in on their side to help lend resources. He says, we cannot be brought down. Spamhaus has more than 80 servers around the world. We've built the biggest DNS server around. Although when the attack first happened, their website did go down. Their mail went down. Some of the public lists were brought down. But everything's back up and it's running well now. Here's the thing I wanted to discuss. Everybody likes spam blocking, right? Except for the spammers. But everybody else on the internet wants spam blocking. And everybody likes a good safe harbor, with a few exceptions perhaps a law enforcement personnel. People like the idea of, like, you know what? I want somewhere where it's nobody's business what I'm doing. You know, let's not assume what I'm doing is illegal. I want some place that protects my privacy. Which of these should win? Ayaz?
Well, I'm always in favor of a safe harbor because it might have more information, more data than you want right there, but at least nothing's getting blocked. These things can get blocked on any different levels. So when you're doing a spam block on this kind of list, or you're doing it on your actual systems or your computers or whatever you're using, I think safe harbor makes it a little bit simpler. I mean, you need a combination of both. But if you had to pick one, I'm always for having too much stuff than not enough, because I don't want things being regulated by a third party. Perhaps I can do a better job to protect myself from these things. But, you know, there are things that seem to be illegal before that changes over time. You think, okay, is this a copyright infringement or not? It could be in the safe harbor kind of server. But if there's a blocker somewhere that's deciding that stuff ahead of time, it could be a little bit messy.
Now, the thing about Spamhaus to understand here, folks, is that it's a voluntary thing. ISPs aren't forced to use Spamhaus block lists, and Spamhaus offers several different kinds of block lists for several different types of situations. It's just that they are used by a lot of people, so they do have a lot of influence. Sarah, what's your take on this?
I am team Spamhaus all the way. I have no idea if Cyberbunker is in cooperation with criminal gangs, but it sounds to me like when I look at the situation here, Cyberbunker got upset that they got put, you know, on some block list, and they're launching an attack against Spamhaus, and a lot of people who have nothing to do with it are suffering. And this is part of the internet that is just the grossest, most pointless, most time-wasting, most resource-intensive garbage that we all have to deal with, and nobody likes it. And yes, I understand the whole safe harbor thing, but these guys are spammers. I don't support it.
Well, and that's the thing, right? If Cyberbunker is, in fact, without a doubt, harboring spammers, and this is the only way to stop them, then that's a good argument. I don't know that that is true for sure. It does seem like it might be likely, since they're a no-questions-asked kind of web host. But at the same time, I don't want every no-questions-asked web host out there to be automatically blocked, because they might harbor spammers. So it becomes a he-said-she-said situation. And I'm probably going to lean towards Spamhaus a little, this because they have a long history. They've also gotten into hot water with people before over their spam enforcement. But I don't think they've tended to abuse that power, and first time for everything, I guess. But if all other things are equal, and I don't know, I'm going to tend to believe Spamhaus before I believe Cyberbunker. But I'm willing to keep my mind open that eventually we might find out it's the opposite. It's maybe less likely, but it's possible. It's a thorny situation. But what I do like most about this, the fact that it's them working it out. Now, I don't like that it's a DDoS that's affecting the rest of the internet with peaking attacks of 300 megabits per second. I think that's out of hand. That's ridiculous. There are better ways.
Well, like
ways
you
to
said, Tom,
conflicts.
This whole, like, do you want to use Spamhaus? It's voluntary. They've got a good track record. If it comes out that Spamhaus was abusing their privileges, as Cyberbunker has alleged, then, you know, ISPs can move away from them. It's, you know, they don't really win by lying, right? I think that the whole point is to try to cut down on abuse of the internet that people don't want.
Yeah, and in fact, the fact that they're resorting, well, again, we don't know that it's them that's doing it, but the fact that a DDoS is happening implies that maybe they couldn't work it out legitimately because they don't have a legitimate case. Again, it's hard to say. Let's go to something prettier. Ayaz Akhtar. Oh, and he also has a story about Flipboard.
I have a story about Flipboard. That's right. Flipboard 2.0. I mentioned this in the news views out for iOS. And if you haven't used Flipboard before, it aggregates your Twitter, Facebook, RSS feeds, and it gives you that nice magazine-like layout that we've seen a lot of. 2.0 brings that ability to have custom magazines created by the user. So what you see is when you have a Flipboard item, you see a little plus button, and when you click that, you'll be able to add that story with a comment to whatever new magazine, whatever you want to title that magazine. Now, these custom magazines are shareable, and other Flipboard users can subscribe to your magazines, and you can make these private as well. So if you wanted to have your own little private magazine, you have that option. Sarah, do you think this custom magazine thing, is this a natural extension for Flipboard?
Well, you know, it kind of reminded me when I first started playing around with it, like Twitter lists, right? I can curate something that's coming from a variety of different sources, package it up and say, this is Sarah's magazine, and you guys could subscribe to it if you think that I pick good content on the internet. And Flipboard is, you know, a nice way to peruse that content. I just don't know how many, I mean, I use Flipboard every single day, and I like to subscribe to a variety of different resources. I'm not so sure how many people's personal magazines I'm interested in subscribing to, but then again, it's such a new feature that maybe somebody hasn't risen to the top as such a great curator, sort of like a, you know, a Jason Kotke of Flipboard or something. He probably already has his own magazine. I haven't checked, but yeah, this is kind of neat. I don't know how much I'm going to basis, but like, hey, Flipboard is evolving. Here's one thing you can do that you couldn't do yesterday.
Now, there is no web component about this actual service. Tom, do you think Flipboard needs to introduce a web component for this to be more widely adopted, or should this just stay from app to app?
No, I think this belongs in an app. I mean, I don't want to see a magazine style layout on my laptop. I haven't since Netscape tried that push thing that they were trying to make everybody use in 1996. It just seems silly to me. That's not the way the web works, but it is the way tablets work, and it looks great on tablets. My problem with Flipboard has always been I need an RSS reader that is comprehensive, that allows me to see every story, know what I've read, know what I haven't. So Flipboard just hasn't been for me. What this does is get me more interested in Flipboard again, because I'm like, well, this is a different thing. This isn't about being an RSS reader. This is about having somebody who's really good at curating content present something that's interesting to read. And like you say, a Jason Kotke or somebody like that would be great. I'm not saying I will use it, but I'm more likely to use that than I am the current Flipboard.
Yeah, when I was playing around with Flipboard 2.0 this morning, I hadn't used Flipboard in a really long time. It's just been sitting in a folder for a while. I'd stopped using it for the most part. But this idea that I can easily save my own things, even just to a private magazine, originally I was starring things and being able to find it that way. But with Google Reader's death, to have something to keep all of my information somewhere, at least on my device, I think that's useful. I think I'm still a little surprised that Flipboard didn't bother to do 2.0 on both Android and iOS at the same time, because Flipboard did come out on iOS first, but they do have an Android client out there, and Android is over 50% of the market. Sarah, do you think there's a reason why they went iOS first again?
I think we lost Sarah, but I would say the reason they went iOS first again is the same reason everybody goes iOS first again. Right?
What, 30%?
It's the place where developers go first because they have the highest amount of money mm-hmm. per app still, and they generally, developers say it's a little easier to develop for than Android still.
I think that's a little strange considering how I know that the i devices are standardized, but there are a number of popular devices like the Galaxy series that got Flipboard first. I'm just thinking those devices should have gotten Flipboard with this upgrade as well, but like I'm saying, just this whole service, this idea of having custom magazines, it seems like not just is this about the users creating custom magazines. From what I've read, Flipboard wants other content producers to be putting things together. So, I mean, does anybody want to make a TNT magazine? Sarah, if you're there. Sarah,
I'm
there.
Here. I'm back, yes. The thing is that I love Flipboard. It's basically my favorite iPad app. So I feel like I'm being a naysayer by saying, it's kind of cool, whatever. A lot of people in chat are like, no, this is great. I think it's just a matter of, you know, do you want a magazine for yourself? It's private. But if there are some public curated magazines that are really cool, then then, you know, good on you, Flipboard. I know there are a lot of people who say, well, you just want RSS readers to work better in Flipboard. And that's sort of a whole nother argument.
Quick correction to our spam house story. Lots of people in the chat room pointed out, I kept saying 300 megabit per second attacks. The attacks were peaking at 300 gigabit per second. I made a typo in my notes. And I didn't notice it. So if you weren't that impressed by 300 megabit per second, may I quote Beatmaster from our chat room, 300, this is spam house. let's talk about TurboTax, fighting to make your taxes stay complicated.
Oh, my goodness. So I read this article. And, you know, I have yet to do my taxes, so it's just... This is a real, you know, hot button story for me. So, all right. So we've got some statistics here. Around 25 million Americans used TurboTax to file their taxes last year in 2012. The Government Accountability Office analysis, that's a real thing, said that this software accounted for more than half of individual returns filed electronically. So a ton of people use TurboTax. TurboTax is owned by Intuit. TurboTax made up 35% of Intuit's $4.2 billion in total revenues last year. So this is extremely hot commodity for Intuit. Now, the government prepared return. This is a concept that's already used in other countries. Some countries like Sweden and Spain and Denmark use it. This is an idea that would estimate your taxes using all of that employer information, bank information that they already send to the IRS before you file your taxes rather than afterwards. Now, the reason that this could be a good idea, and advocates for this type of idea say that lots of millions of taxpayers can save up to $2 billion collectively, not individually, but collectively, and many, many millions of hours in prep costs and time. Because if you've got basically if you have to do an itemized tax return, it might not be for you. But if it's basically just a, hey, I got a file, my employer's information, I've got some bank information, just file it out. Many times the IRS already has all that information for you. There's really no need for you to fill it out. And then the IRS check it against what your employer has filed after the fact, which can cause delays in getting your return and that sort of thing. Taxpayers would have three options under this plan. And by the way, this is not a new concept. This was endorsed by President Reagan back in the day, President Obama during his campaign. Taxpayers could receive a pre-filled return. They could accept it and say, yeah, this looks fine. They could make adjustments, so they would still have the option to say, well, wait a second, some of this stuff isn't right. The IRS is, you know, wanting too much money from me. Or they could reject it and then file a return by other means. So the whole government prepared return is just sort of one option. It's sort of like the healthcare of filing a return. But not everybody wants this. Intuit spent $11.5 million on federal lobbying in the past 5 years. Guess what part of that is about? Opposing IRS government taxed preparation. In 2011, it lobbied on two bills, neither of them actually passed, that would have allowed taxpayers to file pre-filled returns for free. So Intuit, what do you know, has a real incentive in not letting us make this whole tax thing easy, because then we don't buy Intuit's TurboTax software, which, depending on the plan that you get, you know, can be up to $150. Intuit also lobbied on bills in 2007 and 2011 to bar the Treasury Department, the IRS is included in that, from initiating return-free filing. Intuit says, no. This is not us being the bad guy. If the IRS is acting as your tax preparer, basically taxpayers are going to end up paying more money. Grover Norquist, who is the founder and president of the Americans for Tax Reform, says, you know what this is? It is the clear goal to raise taxes in a way that leaves politicians with clean hands. Intuit is also a member of the Computer and Communications Industry Association, which sponsors a Stop IRS Takeover campaign. They call return-free filing a massive expansion of the U.S. government through a big government program. Now, on one hand, you say, well, Intuit, you know, give us a break, right? Filing taxes is like the worst thing ever. We all hate it. It shouldn't have to be more complicated just because you want more money. But can anybody also side with the IRS here? It's tough. Like, who looks worse in this situation? Ayaz, what do you think?
Well, I've studied tax law, and I'm looking at this, and it doesn't surprise me that an industry or even any company has lobbied well, for its own interests. That's not surprising to me. I've always seen these ridiculous insurance exceptions of every piece of the of tax code, at least in my experience. And the thing is, if the IRS wants to actually bother to set up your filing, and then you would have the option to go, okay, I can modify this, that could be something that Intuit could still market themselves as, excuse me, that they would say, look, if you take your prepared return from the IRS and you gave it to us, we can find more money for you, then they have to actually step up their game a little bit more. But it's flat out this idea of saying, you know, stop IRS takeover. That's a really great thing to say because it gets people fired up. You know, the government's coming in. They're going to take and pay attention to what's going on. They're already taking your money. It's not that big a deal, arguably. But I guess I'm not surprised by the story. And I don't know why it'd be harder to make things easier for people. Because, you know, it'd be nice to make it easy.
It's probably not surprising to you that Intuit has spent so much money on lobbying in favor of its own bottom line. But, you know, does return free? Does government filled out returns freak you out? Do you think that there'll be more people who end up paying more money because they don't really understand what the government is doing?
I have been an Intuit user of Quicken since 1996. I have previously used their TurboTax system to file my taxes. And I can say that Intuit, as far as I can tell, is committed to making sure that they change as little as possible to make as much money off of you as possible and make things as inconvenient as possible since they have almost no competition in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So that's the way it feels to me these days. I would say that that's probably what they're up to here as well. Let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Gazelle, the fast and simple way to make some money. You want a new iPhone, iPad, Samsung, Galaxy, or HTC phone before you get the new one, or if you've already upgraded, get rid of that old one. Don't just throw it in a drawer. Don't throw it away. That's irresponsible. Find out if Gazelle will take it off your hands. They'll give you money. The fact they'll buy broken iPhones and iPads in a lot of cases, and it's so easy to do. Listen, if you're like, well, wait a minute, why would I do it this way? Because it'll take you virtually no time, and you'll get money, and you get to keep the quote for 30 days while you figure out if you really want to get rid of the old phone or not. Go to Gazelle.com. That's Gazelle.com. Find your item. Tell Gazelle the condition. They'll even buy broken iPhones and iPads. Like I said, get a risk-free offer for your gadgets and lock it in for 30 days while you figure out what you're going to replace that old phone with. You'll get paid fast by check or PayPal once you send it off to them. They've paid $50 million to over 500,000 customers. It's risk-free. Once you lock in an offer, you have 30 days to return it. And if you don't return it, no big deal. And Gazelle also wipes your data off the device for free. Free shipping. Most items qualify for a free box. Fast processing and no hassles. Find out what your iPhone, your iPad, or your Android smartphone are worth. Take a minute. Go to Gazelle.com to find out. Sell your used iPhone or Samsung Galaxy smartphone today at Gazelle.com. We thank them for their support of Tech News Today. All right, let's talk a little bit about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Over the weekend, TechDirt reports that a new draft resolution amending the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act came out, and nobody can really explain why. Now, you may think, oh yeah, I've heard about this. It's Aaron's Law. Representative Zoe Lofgren has been pushing it to amend the CFAA so that it's less punitive, and the punishment fits the crime more. That's a different one. That one's been around for a while. It doesn't seem to be getting traction right now. And it very simply amends the law to eliminate prosecution for authorized access and to get rid of cases that are merely violations of the end user license agreement or attempts to protect your own personal identifying information. This new draft that came out in the House Judiciary Committee over the weekend increases the prison term from 5 to 10 years for unauthorized access and damages. It would make traffic in passwords punishable by up to 10 years in prison. It would make failed attempts, even when you didn't succeed, punishable as harshly as successful ones. Here's the quote. Whoever conspires to commit or attempts to commit an offense under subsection A of this subsection shall be punished as provided for the completed offense. So even if you just talk about breaking your end user license agreement, you could be theoretically prosecuted under this. More than one attempt would then be tied into racketeering charges, and tampering with critical infrastructure like the power grid, transit, and the stock market would be punishable by up to 30 years. Now, that last one, I take no issue with, adding in increased penalties for tampering with critical infrastructure, probably important. Also important is getting the critical infrastructure to protect themselves better. But who benefits from this version of the bill? Because whether it passes or not, it's meant to kind of force that Aaron's Law proposal from Zoe Lofgren to compromise, to come back towards the center. Aya, has any thoughts?
These punishments sound relatively insane. The only thing I could think of why these things would go up, why the penalties go from 5 years to 10 years and that sort of thing would be for a deterrent purpose, maybe, in the theory that people are actually thinking about the penalties when they are engaging in these behaviors. But, I mean, a lot of these laws, I don't believe people are even contemplating when they are phishing for passwords or whatever they're doing. There's not necessarily a thought process of, oh, I could get caught. This could get worse. But, I mean, maybe 10 years. I don't know if that's going to cause a deterrent purpose. But that's the only thing I could figure out when I'm looking at this, because it doesn't seem like it's going to do anything other than potentially increase the amount of inmates you have.
I'm trying to make sense of this. It's like, oh, okay, we've got Aaron's Law, and then we have something that seems wildly different and really scary. And yeah, I mean, longer prison terms. I'm not sure who benefits from this, except people who are extremely fearful of other people trying to figure out how things work. Hey, you know, I understand that at its core, this is an attempt to cut down on criminal activity. But as we've all seen, that's not always the case. So these numbers just look really, really scary for anybody who gets caught in the crossfire of the law.
It strikes me a little bit as the same issue that happened with copyright law. The difference is, I think the damages from cybercrime, so-called cybercrime, are much more demonstrable and much more real than the damages from copyright have ever been demonstrated to be. But the reaction is the same. We don't really understand how to properly protect ourselves from these infringements, or in this case, from these attacks. So let's pass a law that sets the legal boundary so far out that anyone who comes close will get nabbed, and that'll protect us. And the thing is, that won't protect you. The folks who are doing the really bad stuff, don't worry about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It punishes more, as you can see, the people that are getting prosecuted and convicted are not the cyber criminals that are hacking in and actually stealing and damaging data. It's the people who are penetration testing. It's the people who are hacking, or it's activists. It's the wrong crowd. You're targeting and getting the wrong crowd with this sort of thing. So I think it makes an industry feel better about itself, but I don't think it actually does what it should be doing, which is stopping, in this case, the very demonstrable damage that can be done. All right. Well, here's a lighter side to corporate infrastructure. Maybe more of these corporations would be much less worried about cybercrime if they took to cats.
Well, Tom, you'd think that cats are harmless, but you would be wrong. Over 2 million people have gotten an email with the subject line, "Check out these kitties, smiley face." That is an email that shows a photo of a little Turkish Angora cat named Dr. Zeus with a little purple mohawk, and then it includes an attachment or a link promising more cat photos. You see where this is going, right? It's a setup. Tech departments are actually sending out this email to teach employees a lesson. This is an email by a company called FishMe Incorporated. They're operating out of Virginia, and it's a simulated cyber attack created to find out, hey, who in this big company that has sensitive information is susceptible to social engineering? Because most big network breaches end up starting this way, right? You always hear about, oh, it was an employee who didn't get it, and then they clicked on a link, and now their computer's affected, and it all goes to heck. Another company, Digital Defense, out of San Antonio, does something similar. Says, we're not really trying to get anybody fired. This is not, you know, about getting anybody in trouble. This is about employees figuring out how malicious techniques work, knowing how to spot them, and knowing not to fall prey. I mean, we were talking just the other day about whether or not flight attendants should understand how tablets work, right? It's sort of like, well, it's not really their job, but we want to make sure that, you know, we don't all suffer because people don't understand how it works. Here's another good one, though. So FishMe, the company who had the cat email, First has another scam that they run. An employee gets an email from a senior manager with an attachment, says something about potential bonuses for certain employees. Then another email comes quickly afterwards attempting to recall that first email. So the employee goes, ooh, the first email is juicy. I got to get it. I got to open that attachment before it goes away. And that's, you know, that's where everything goes to heck. This is great. Another tactic.
Seems cruel. Tactic. Like if it appears to come from your boss and it hasn't, I mean, and it's on the internal network, is it just trying to teach them to pay attention to headers?
What's that?
Is it trying to teach them to pay attention to the headers?
Well, possibly. I mean, some employees would already know to do that. But others, you know, there are certain, I think all of us can say, well, you know, every once in a while you get something where you go, God, that looks really good. But there's always like a telltale something, right? There's too many exclamation points or there's something that's, you know, it doesn't look like the right logo or something's misspelled. I mean, there are just a lot of triggers that you get used to trying to spot. There's another tactic. I got to tell you about this one. It's a good one. Digital security company TrustWave Holdings. A guy who works for them says what he'll do is he'll drop a thumb drive or a CD in a bathroom or maybe a driveway or a nearby coffee shop of companies that hire him. And then maybe the company's logo is on it or a competitor's logo. A label reads confidential. And he says almost without fail, an employee at the company that, you know, he's been secretly hired by will find one of these decoys, stick it in a computer, and then that contains software that takes over other computers and hijacks built-in cameras and takes photos of the employees and so on and so forth. So, I mean, this is sort of, I mean, I almost have to smile because I'm like, hey, that's kind of clever. But this is, I think, actually a really important thing for large companies to invest in. You've got a ton of employees, hundreds, maybe thousands of people who simply don't understand how this works. And there is evidence that the more that employees figure out, so that was a fake thing, the more that they won't fall prey to it next time. Of course, people who want sensitive information are also going to get smarter over time. But I don't know. Tom, do you think this is a game of whack-a-mole or is this actually a good investment for large companies?
No, I think this is great, actually. There may be ways it's implemented that are bad, but I think this is corporations actually taking some action to secure their networks. And education is not the solution to security, but education is part of the solution. It may be even a minor part of the solution, but this is good. This is a way to actually get people to pay attention, like, clicking on that attachment that appears to come from my boss could be a problem. I need to pay more attention. I need to learn about this stuff. Ayaz, what do you think?
I think it's going to be used by a lot of people as an excuse why they didn't get memos, why they didn't bother to open things. They're going to be like, hey, listen, I said it's from my boss, but I'm not going to open it. I was told that if there are cats involved, I'm not going to open this. On the serious side, though, I do think this is the right way to get people to understand what's going on. I mean, there's a lot of ways for people to get their computers infected. It drives the IT people crazy. Then they lock down the systems. The end worker gets annoyed, and this keeps going back and forth. If the person using a computer has an actual understanding of, okay, there's danger out there, even coming into my inbox, I should be more aware of it, maybe this will actually produce more secure systems throughout whatever company out there.
All right, let's talk about Microsoft Office. Now, we know that Blue won't be the final name, but now we've got another code name out there. What's this one about?
It's Gemini. Now, Mary Gioppoli was reporting that Microsoft is working on a Blue version of Office, and it's codenamed Gemini. It's a wave of Office releases coming over the next 2 years. Now, Wave 1 will show up with Windows Blue, and that's supposed to come out in the fall, and there will be an updated version of PowerPoint, Word, Excel, and OneNote. Currently, the latest version of Office, they're all desktop-style apps. If you use Windows RT, when you go into Office, you go into a desktop, and you have your version of Office there. Tom, do you think we should expect full Metro-style versions of Office coming up?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we will. I mean, we have this weird cobbled-together Office thing going on the Surface RT where you can use all of the Office things, but they have to take you to the desktop. I think Microsoft would like to just get rid of the desktop on RT altogether because it is confusing and they know it. So if they had Metro versions, the need to allow you to easily get to that desktop interface in RT would go away. I think that, to me, that's one of the biggest arguments for this.
Yeah, earlier this week, Windows Blue leaked, and there's a bunch of screenshots and even demos showing off that a lot of the settings that used to be in just the control panel in the desktop, very hard to get to, are now baked into the new start screen, the new settings there. Paul Thurrott was saying that he expects this to mean that Microsoft is easing out the desktop Sarah, do you think Microsoft will actually kill off the desktop, especially if they have Metro-style, whatever they're calling it, Windows Store-style versions of Office?
Well, it seems like this is a transition that, you know, it's messy, right? This whole thing, every time we talk about these stories, I think, gosh, Microsoft is, they have to invest so much of this, like, careful transition to make sure that people aren't more confused than they are already, at least people like me. And yeah, I think that this is, you know, slowly but surely, this is the way that Microsoft is going, wants to go, probably needs to go. And yeah, I think that Microsoft has really invested in the new way of looking at stuff, right? The, you know, these Metro style tiles. And although it's tough for some people to transition, this is, it's a big step forward for Microsoft. And I think in the long run, it's the right idea.
Yeah, I think Microsoft having consistency for its applications from Office to all the new applications that are coming out with Windows Blue, all these revised versions of their applications make sense. Although I'm finding it a bit confusing at some point where the desktop, just because you have a front screen that has tiles up on it, instead of it being a vista of grass or wherever it is, what is really the difference if these applications still work the same, especially if the windowing system with all the snapping is becoming similar to the way the desktop worked? It just seems like it's a revision to the desktop in general. And the thing people are fighting is that they are used to the old one. But I think a new version of Office will definitely make people think, oh, okay, this is the way it works. It seems a lot more like, it seems more consistent. And this is going to actually, I think this is the major push that's going to get people to go, oh, yeah, that desktop, that's just another application. I hardly ever use that.
I don't know about that. Interesting theory. However, I believe it is time, if everyone is in agreement, for us to insert our individual keys into the randomizer machine and fire it up.
Hey, it worked.
Yeah, look at that. We got a story from Boing Boing. Jenny Jardin over there posted about a troll from YouTube. Now, you all know YouTube trolls and their reputation. This one sent his comment via postal mail to the uploader's home. Now, here's the thing. It started because it was sort of a warning of like, hey, you put a video up about your geek wedding, but your invitations show your home address. And maybe you don't want to do this. I'm not going to use this for any bad purpose, but you know, I'm sending it to your home because I was able to get your home address. But then it goes on to start criticizing the video and the invitations and just turns into a total YouTube troll.
Boo.
I don't know. I think I glazed over myself. Troll comments on YouTube. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, but they're not on YouTube. It was mailed to your house.
That's even more.
Yeah, I mean, that sucks. You know?
Somebody paid money to send it through the system. It was, you know, delivered on a truck and brought to your house. I mean, I guess this guy, at least if he's going to troll you, he's paying for it. And it's not going to be with the rest of your snail mail spam. But now you got to pay attention to these postcards that are just jerky letters.
It's a good point. Bill Gates' old proposal from the early 2000s to get rid of spam was to put microcharges on email. You wouldn't stop this guy. He's willing to plunk down whatever any forever stamp costs these days.
That is a dedicated troll, though. I mean, he's willing to put his money where his mouth is. So
what got me is when I started reading, I was like, oh, he's actually just trying to show like, hey, you guys, you know, This is what could happen if you put your email, your mail address out there. Maybe it's a little heavy-handed. You could have just put it in the comments. But it's a demonstration. But then he goes on to basically troll them over the video. It's crazy.
Trolling trolls via the U.S. Postal Service. All right. So calendar. BlackBerry earnings report is tomorrow, March 28th. I don't know why I'm smiling. The earnings reports tomorrow is going to be very serious indeed. And Build 2013, which is Microsoft's big developer conference, is taking place June 26th through the 28th at Moscone Center in San Francisco. Registration opens on April 2nd. So if you're interested, mark that down in your calendar.
You're going to find out about Blue if you go. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
We got an email from Alan. He says, the thing about the T-Mobile pricing is that if you hold on to your phone for more than 2 years, your monthly phone bill goes down. This doesn't happen on any other carrier. Anecdotally, most of my non-technically inclined friends and relatives hold on to their phones longer than 2 years, some substantially longer. We actually got a bunch of emails from people saying similar things, that the T-Mobile plans do become cheaper once you hang on to those phones because they just changed all of their plans.
The iPhone in particular is not, that is not always the case. I saw a couple of different analyses today. And in one case, the AT&T plan was actually cheaper over the life of the iPhone. So you might want to do some investigations. It depends on how they configure the plans, though, how these comparisons work out. So for you and the way you use it, the T-Mobile plan might still be cheaper. But you are paying $20 extra a month. And if you need a higher rate data plan, it might not end up saving you that much money. It will in some cases. But like anything else, T-Mobile needs to make money. So they're not going to give you that much of a discount. Good pricey plan. Thanks to everybody for all of their feedback. Let's finish up the show with a thanks to our subredditors, especially those subredditors who are our moderators. Those are the folks in there making sure that this is a useful thing for you guys to use. So huge thanks to TD Enterprises, Jacob Miller, Kildy the janitor. I'm saying it wrong again, aren't I? It's just killed? Anyway,
those Tom poor Gerke janitors, you know,
and Rolmos.
Cleaning
all in
up
there,
after us all the time.
Making sure that subreddit is useful for you to submit your stories and vote them up and down for us. We appreciate everything you do. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, TNT@twit.tv. And you can give us a call, leave us a voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. Alexis Madrigal joins us tomorrow. We'll see you then.